Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading from True West Magazine. This article comes from True West's November-December 1960 edition. Cookies for Cutthroats. The man walked slowly to within a few feet of us. Pa Nelson didn't feel much like Santa Claus when he saw the six-shooter staring at him, but he had come on a Christmas mission, and he aimed to carry it out. By Dick Nelson. Editor's note. Dick Nelson was born on the plains of western Kansas. When a small lad, he went with his family to a Wyoming cattle ranch. After a spell of riding the range, he got into railroading. When in his 80s, he made a discovery that surprised him. He had a flair for public speaking and writing. His boyhood brush with the Buck Hanby gang, we're sure you'll agree with us, is an unusual a Christmas story as you've ever read. It happened 72 years ago, when Crazy Horse and Custer were fresh memories in the new ranches of the Wyoming West of the Black Hills. Ever since, I've tried to measure the full meaning of goodwill to men by the lesson Preacher Kieran taught when he sent us up Salt Creek Canyon with Christmas donuts and cookies for Buck Hanby's gang. The preacher urged it as much for us boys, I know now, as he did for the gunmen. If you want compassion, you've got to show some, he used to rumble through his black gorge of that big beard. If you want a friend, be one. He and Dad planned it, I still believe, while my brother Frank and I were lashing the SG organ into our wagon the morning after gospel service at the Quarter Circle W Ranch. Nothing so good for growing boys as an experience in the realities, Preacher said, steadying one corner of the Estee down the mess hall steps and across the yard to our rig. Dad only grunted. But he and Preacher walked back to the mess hall stoop and talked in low tones. Frank and I spread blankets over Mother's beloved box of angel music and lashed it tight. Preacher, at that point, 10 days and 170 cowpony miles out of Custer City, and with a 100-mile circuit of sagebrush and drifted canyons still ahead, looked a little like a buffalo bull himself. We watched him talking earnestly to Dad. Suddenly, his mittened hand shot out in an oratorical sweep, and we caught the words Hanby and Salt Creek Canyon. Dad's back was stiff for a second. Then he nodded. As they approached the wagon, Frank gave a low whistle of amazement, but kept quiet. Preacher held out a furry paw to each of us. Peace and goodwill to you and yours and all men, Brother Nelson, he boomed, then waddled away toward his pinto. Dad drove fast and in silence. Frank and I huddled against the blanketed sides of the organ. Once, as our eyes met, Frank leaned toward me and hissed, Buck Hanby. You hear that? Suppose we'll get to see him? I opened my mouth to answer, then thought better of it. Dad's lips and eyes framed the words so obviously that he might just as well have shouted, Hush up! Frank looked up, too. He was quicker than I was. Before I could think, he was shouting the chorus of Throw Out the Lifeline. I tremoloed in on the third line. The days slipped by. I had all but forgotten those spine-tingling whispers about Buck Hanby's gang when, while eating breakfast December 23rd, Dad said to my mother, Molly, wish you and the girls would make a big batch of donuts and cookies today. Early tomorrow, I aim to take the boys on a call. A call? Where will you find anybody to call on tomorrow? That's the day before Christmas. Christmas Eve, you know? Know it well enough, Dad looked sheepish. Preacher says goodwill to men means everybody. I aim we should live up to it and take a parcel to the Hanby gang. For a second, I thought Mother would keel over, but finally a smile slipped across her lips. Why, of course, she laughed. The Hanbys are our gang, aren't they? We're really responsible for them at Christmas. Get busy, May and Dot. Quick with the dishes. May, set the fat kettle on. We're going to make donuts and sugar cookies for, our neighbors. Frank trailed me over to the corral before we finished our chores that morning. Jumping jackrabbits, he whispered. Suppose we'll really miss Christmas? Dunno, I managed to whisper back before Frank's voice excitedly went on. Hanby's killed a lot of men. Bang, bang, just like that. The kids over at the Quarter Circle W and said so. Betcha we're gonna have to sneak up on him and shoot it out before we can deliver Ma's cookies. Dad's voice came from behind us. Stow the blood and thunder stuff. You've both got work ahead of you. I scuttled off the fence and started back toward the saddle room. Frank was more deliberate. We really get to carry guns, Dad? He asked. Nobody carries any guns but me, and I don't want to hear a word more. But, gee whiz, they're... I heard you the first time. Everybody says they're killers. Dad's voice was slow. They haven't killed anybody around here. When they do, we'll handle it. Until they do, they're just a bunch of lonely men hiding out in that canyon. They've got as much need for a Christmas parcel as you have. Maybe more. Yes, sir. Frank jumped to the ground and scampered off. By noon, the kitchen smelled like all the candy and Sundance and Deadwood rolled into one gorgeous aroma. There were sugar cookies cut like bells. There were donuts sprinkled with cinnamon sugar, some twisted and shiny brown that seemed a foot long. There were square cookies perfumed with sorghum and brown sugar, and star-shaped cookies with Merry Christmas dribbled on them in pink frosting. Ma and the girls wrapped all of them in soft tan paper. Frank and Dad and I rode out early the next morning. Salt Creek Canyon was northeast of our place, not far from where U.S. 16 today swings up between the oil city and Osage. A few months earlier, Buck Hanby and his men rode in from the south and holed up in there. Lots of gossip, Dad told us, as we jogged across the hills that afternoon. Nobody really knows what it's all about. If and when the sheriff wants Hanby, he'll go in after him. Until then, he's our neighbor, and this is Christmas Eve. When we reached the canyon mouth, Dad stopped. Single file from here on, he ordered. Frank, you're last. If they shoot, you light out for Mondell's. Tell him to round up a posse. Bushes grew high along the trail, thick enough for a dozen men to hide. I fixed my eyes on Dad. He rode with his head high and kind of smiling, but he had the reins bunched in his left hand. The right rested on his thigh, close to his colt. As we topped the rise to the canyon floor, a smudge of smoke eddied up from a log and stone dugout, and just then a man stepped out from behind a scrub pine and walked toward us, hands tight against his trouser seams. Sit right here. Let him come to us, Dad ordered, without turning his head. Then, while my teeth chattered, he raised that right arm and waved it, real casual and friendly-like. The man came on, keeping close to the trees, his hands still tight along his pants legs. He was young and limber, with coal-black hair. He wasn't smiling any. Dad sat statue still. He gave a little smile. I sure hope, he said, Preacher Curran has a real nice Christmas. The man walked slowly to within a dozen feet of us. He was not much older than I was. He looked us up and down, stared down the trail behind us, up into the bushes and trees, finally to the top of the canyon wall. His hands moved away from the slim hips, then, for the first time. The right one came up in a little wave of greeting. Hi, he said. Looking for something? We're the Nelsons, from down on Oil Creek, Dad said. Your nearest neighbors, and it's Christmas Eve. Thought we'd come calling. The youngster just stood there. You know how women folk are, Dad grinned. A neighbor's a neighbor till he proves himself otherwise. They made some donuts and fancy fixings. Allowed as you might not have good cooking facilities up here. You mean, the youngster licked his lips. You mean the women bake some donuts for us? Dad nodded down toward his saddlebag. Open her up, he invited. Taste one. If we ain't welcome here on Christmas Eve, carry the rest of them on in, and we'll jog back home now. Getting kind of late anyway. Wordlessly, the youngster glided to the saddlebag and snatched out the top packet. Ma's precious rice paper ripped open. The saddlebag contests began, sending out the headiest perfume ever wafted up Salt Creek. The youngster buried his face against the package. When he looked up, there was a tear trickle down each side of his nose. I swan, he gulped. I do swan. You wait here. I'll be right back. He ran off towards the dugout, holding the packet in front of him. Dad sat stock still. Preacher, he nodded mostly to himself, I guess you're right on the bullseye. Once, after the youngster had kicked open the dugout door and darted through, package first, we saw the door open again and a bearded face peer out. It was a good 5 minutes before black hair appeared again, his hands once more tight against his pants. Fellers say you to leave the horses here, he twanged. Bring them goodies if you still a mind to, and, mister, you catch them shooting irons with me. Dad got down, handed over his colt, and didn't so much as glance at the saddle scabbard when his Winchester rifle gleamed. He piled all the parcels from the saddlebag onto his left arm, then beckoned to us. I thought I'd fall flat on that trail. Frank's cheeks showed white, but we single-filed toward the dugout, with young black hair stalking at the rear, holding Dad's colt. Dad pushed the slab pine door open and stood still. I edged up to him and felt Frank's head pressing against my shoulder. The first thing I could see in the gloomy room were four twinkling lights. Then the lights resolved into gun barrels. They were pointed straight at us, with the man behind each. Dad spoke gently. If this is the way to say Merry Christmas, I guess we've been brought up wrong. The skinny fellow in front tossed his gun on the bunk behind him. Put 'em away, boys, he ordered, and walked over to Dad with his right hand out. I'm real sorry, Mr. Nelson, sir. We're wrongfully hunted men up here, taking every precaution. I'm highly honored, sir, for this yulesome visit. The three other guns slicked back into holsters. The men walked toward Dad, each with his right hand extended. Each grabbed Dad's free hand and shook it, mumbling, "Pleased to meet you." The last one bent his head low over Ma's parcels. "You mean," he said, "we can just sit here all day Christmas and smell them lovely things?" Skinny laughed then, and Dad laughed too. Guess there might be more where they came from, if we're really going to be neighbors, he said. Neighbors is as neighbors does, we used to say back in Dodge City, said Skinny, waving a hand toward a bench. Have seats, gentlemen. You say Dodge City? Dad asked. We homesteaded in Kansas before we came here. Buck can be, sir, Skinny said mournfully. I'm a hunted man, Mr. Nelson. These here my friends and supporters. Haven't heard of any warrants out, Dad drawled. Just a lot of rumor kicked up because of the way you're living back here. Hanby sat silently, head bowed. Buck's got real bad enemies down in Kansas, one of the men said. His brother run a place out Dodge City way. Buck's riding into town one night and hears shooting. He walks in and there's three fellers, pegging away with his brother, sprawled out on the floor, looking real dead. Buck just hauled steel and let all three of them have it. Turned out he was a better shot than the others. His brother was just hugging the floor to stay away from bullets. Them three fellers were all the way to glory when the sheriff showed. Rushed Buck to the calaboose and writ him out a murder charge agin him. Gentlemen here, Buck smiled. They kind of rescued me. We come up here real fast, Aim to stay a year or so. Anyway, his pal went on, till your sheriff comes snooping, or we hear there's a new judge in Dodge. What's to be, Dad said, is the Lord's will. Right now, I reckon you ought to have some roast antelope to go along with all we brought. Blackie there? Buck nodded toward young Black Hair. Is real handy on a rifle. He can shoot buttons off a shirt at 200 yards. My knees felt funny again as I thought back at the three of us poised against the skyline. Down our way, we have plenty of antelope, Dad said. Blackie could pick one off easy. If you'd care to, send him over first thing in the morning. I suspect Molly has some potatoes and root stuff and maybe a little homemade bread and butter to go with it. Mr. Nelson, Buck hung his head again for a moment. If I was a rightfully godly man, the way I was brought up, I'd say, God bless you and the rest of your family. Anytime you got a mind to it, Dad said, uncrossing his legs, the Lord will have his ears open. All you got to do is get down on your knees and start talking. The four sat like rocks. Dad got up, beckoned to Frank and me, and started for the door. Black Hair held out a hand with Dad's loaded Colt. Dad took it, walked to the door, and let Frank and me sidle past. Merry Christmas, boys, he said. Blackie, stop around in the morning. He closed the door quietly. In silence, we crossed the open space, mounted, and started off. The first stars glimmered, and far away a light shone that could only be home. Dad, Frank said finally, remember what Preacher said about if you want a friend, be a friend? Well, I sure know now what he meant. Dad patted Frank between the shoulder blades. Just hang on to it, boy, for the rest of your life. Copyright 1958 by Lovick Pierce. Used by permission. Here's a selection from True West Magazine's November-December 1961 edition. King of All Winters. At first glance, the lush Maple Creek country of southern Saskatchewan was a cattleman's paradise. But the winter of 06 and 07 turned paradise into an Arctic wasteland of blizzards, snow, and record cold. By T.B. Long. Editor's note. True West is happy to bring you our first in a series of book condensations. In years to come, T.B. Long's book will be as valuable for its scarcity as it is today for the faithful recording of a way of life that can never be brought back or lived again, except on a printed page. The following, from 70 Years a Cowboy, published by Western Printers Association Limited, Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada, copyright 1959, by T.B. Long, will make you draw a little closer to the fire and wonder how in tarnation the old-timers ever lived through all the trouble that nature and a new land could throw at them. After the winter of 1904, many of us could see that our Madison Valley range in Montana was becoming overstocked. More people were moving in, and the old-timers were getting more cattle to run. All the upper valley, where we had ample range before, was now rapidly being overrun with sheep. I could see that in the near future, the cowboys' work would be very limited. The ranchers would either have to cut down their herds or run them in fenced pastures which they owned. This would not be to my liking at all, as the cowboy life was the only one I understood. We heard of a great abundance of grass and open range in the southern Saskatchewan country in Canada and the Jeffers Cattle Company, namely Walter Long, Burt Maynard, and Steve Gainan, were the first ones to make a decision. They appointed Tom Whitney and me to go up and look over this new range. These men knew that some move had to be made soon. In March 1905, Tom and I took the branch line train at Norris, Montana, for Maple Creek, Saskatchewan. Stepping off the train at Maple Creek, we were met by Fred Garrison, whom we had known on the Madison and whose father had moved to Canada a year or two previously. He had been informed by mail of our coming. It was about 32 miles to the Garrison Ranch, and we enjoyed every minute of the trip. We were only a few miles out of the old cow town of Maple Creek before I could see that this was a great range country. There was grass everywhere, and more of it than we had seen for a long time. The cypress hills to the south did not look very high to us old mountain men, but as we drew near them, we were impressed with their timber and beautiful scenery. In this flat prairie country, the hills were sort of set apart like islands on the sea, or oasis in the desert. On a gentle rising slope of the prairie land gave way to brush and timber. Winding our way through this timber, we finally came out on a huge, flat-topped bench. Here, several years' growth of grass rippled in the wind, knee-deep to a horse, as far as the eye could see. What a cattle heaven this could be! Already my mind was made up, and I am sure Tom's was, too. We arrived at the ranch about dark. Here, we received a warm welcome indeed, as the Garrisons were lonesome for friends from their old home range, and we talked far into the night. Before daylight, we were up and off to look at the country over. And what a country! It is just impossible to describe the amount of grass we saw. There was free range everywhere. Tom and I knew then that this was going to be our new home, and after a few days of just enjoying this cattle heaven, we picked out two homesteads on Sucker Creek, just north of Cypress Lake. Bursting with eagerness and information, we arrived back at Ennis on April 1st. Preparations were started immediately to make the move. It was no small job convincing my wife, Esther, and Mrs. Whitney that they should leave the land they had always lived in. Esther had sincerely hoped that I would not like the North Country, but upon seeing my enthusiasm, she consented to go. The Whitneys had two small children, Audrey and Cecil, which made it a little harder for Mrs. Whitney to make up her mind, but at last she also agreed. By the last of April, we were ready to go, and, trailing the stock to Norris, we loaded out about 100 head of horses and 1,500 head of cattle. These belonged to the Jeffers Cattle Company, Tom Whitney, and me. There were several who decided to go along and help on this venture, some with the idea of staying and some just for the trip. They were Clarence and Paul Jeffers, Asa and Art Whitney, Tom's oldest sons, Lud Piper, Steve and Leo Gainan, Harry Wiles, Tom Whitney, and I. The nearest point by trail in the United States to our destination was Harvey, Montana. The women and children took the passenger train and went on ahead, while the men stayed with the stock. As we had two full stock trains, we were highballed right through and reached Harvey without having to feed. We arrived at Harvey that night. The trains no sooner came to a halt than the cowboys hit the dirt and were gone in a rush to remove the dust of travel, both externally and internally. Not being a drinking man, I hastened to the hotel where I found two very lonesome women, already more than a little homesick. The following day was one of great activity. The cattle and horses were unloaded and at once driven out on grass north of town. Here we set up a camp and held the herd for 2 days while we purchased wagons, harness, tents, and all needed supplies for our journey north. The third morning, after our arrival or so, we got the herd strung out for about 2 miles, and our 100-mile journey got underway. The weather was nice, there was plenty of grass, and our equipment was new, and all in all, the world looked pretty rosy. There was to be a big sun dance of all the Indian tribes at Harvey soon, and we had no sooner topped the hills of the Milk River breaks until we started meeting Indians. These were mostly Crees from Canada, an endless wave of them. They were traveling in wagons, afoot, and on horses, and were dressed in buckskins, robes, and blankets of all colors of the rainbow. There were chiefs with their feathery headdresses, squaws with papooses on their backs, young prancing bucks, and noisy half-grown children. These, in their great numbers, were very friendly, but they did slow down our drive tremendously, and they were in our way clear to the Canadian border. Needless to say, they were also a great worry to our women folks who had never seen so many Indians before. The hardships that Esther and Mrs. Whitney endured during this trip and the following years would make a book in itself. They were cooking for 14, taking care of two little ones, moving after every meal and sleeping in tents through rain, wind, mud, and all other adverse conditions of the trail. Esther has often said that it would not have been unbearable if there had not been two of them. These pioneer women were just plain hardy, game, and tough. I sometimes think they could stand more than a man. Never has enough credit been given these women who gave their all to the settling of the land. We had very little trouble and made pretty good time until we crossed the Canadian border. Then we hit rain. When we came to Battle Creek, just north of the border, we found it full to the banks, fed by heavy rains in the Cypress Hills. Ludby Piper had purchased a new saddle in Harvey, and he continually worried about the fact that you must pay duty on new articles brought across the border. On unsaddling that night, Lud very carefully covered his pride and joy with the saddle blanket to protect it from the rain. We were all standing, talking, when we heard a startled cry from Lud, and turning toward the roaring creek, we saw Bert swinging Lud's new saddle over his head. After a couple of wind-up swings, he let it fly with a splash into Battle Creek. With an angry yelp, Lud took off in hot pursuit down the creek, where, after a fast ride down the swift current, he found the saddle caught in a whirlpool near the shore. In a short time, he reappeared, covered with mud, but triumphant, the dripping saddle over one shoulder. As he trudged into camp, Bert called, "There, Lud, your duty troubles are all over. I helped you out. They can sure see now that she has been used." The rain lasted for 3 days, and we held the herd for several days to let the gumbo mud dry. Our camp was near John Badger's ranch. He at once insisted that the women folks stay at the house with his family. John Badger was a fine fellow and a wonderful host. We were all entertained continually by his wit and stories, some of which I still remember. On my first visit, to start the conversation, I mentioned that it was quite a rain. John, with a twinkle in his eye, replied, "Well, I don't know. We have some pretty good rains here. I saw it rain a beer bottle full in 10 minutes one time." Another favorite story of his concerned a trip on an extremely dark night with his friend Billy Gregg. He said that he thought it was the darkest night he had ever seen. It was so dark that when he went to blow his nose, he blew Billy's instead. The second day after we pulled out, it commenced to rain again. Toward the evening, we came to the White Mud River, just below Cypress Creek. After making camp, we learned that there was a roundup wagon and crew camped a short distance from us, so we hastened over for a visit. Upon arriving at their camp, we learned that this was the T-Down Bar Wagon, Harry Otterson roundup boss. This was my first meeting with Ira Triplett, and I remember it well. He was riding a spooky horse, and as it had started to rain again, he decided to put on his slicker. He hung his reins on the saddle horn, reached back, and untied his slicker. And when the slicker unfolded in the wind, his horse jumped and started to run. Ira went on, very unconcernedly, putting on the slicker with his horse at a dead run, And I think the horse made about a mile and a half around and around the camp before he finally got the last button fastened. Then, and only then, did he pick up his reins, pull the panting horse down, and ride casually back to camp. We made the last 10 miles to our summer range and established a permanent camp. The tents were banked up, an ample wood supply gathered, and a corral built to hold our saddle horses. At Maple Creek, we paid the duty on our stock and equipment. The duty was light, and the Canadian authorities were very nice and receptive to our entrance. They took our word for everything and did not even inspect our herds. Having taken care of this, Tom took the train to Regina to record our brands, and the rest of us returned home after purchasing some hay machinery. When Tom got back, we lost no time branding the stock with our new iron. When the job was finished, it was getting on toward June. After fixing our camps up a little better, we had to start putting up hay to be sure that we were secure for the following winter. There was no problem finding hay in this sea of grass. Anywhere you went, you could cut hay that would go from 3/4 of a ton to a ton to the acre. By the middle of September, we had enough hay to winter the calves, which was all we planned to feed. All through the haying, our women folk again proved their mettle. They cooked for the crews, living in tents through rain and heat. Our horses were continually trying to head back to their home range, and the women rode for them and held them along with their other work. Sometimes this required a lot of riding, but they took care of it. The hay being all up, we hastened to get our houses built for winter. I was able to get what logs I needed close at hand, but a round trip of 50 miles was required to get the finished lumber. For the trip, I took 4 horses and 1 wagon and was able to bring all I needed in 1 load, but it was a large one. By the middle of October, I had the house finished. Earl Whitney, Tom's son, who was about 18 years old, and I were elected to gather cattle and throw them on winter range closer to home. They were ranging north of the Cypress Hills in an area of 20 to 30 miles in diameter. Although the days were crowded with hard work, they bring back memories of many good times and many laughs. Earl was an all-around good hand and just full of the dickens. He was strictly a daredevil who would try anything once. We had a lot of fun on this gather. One day about noon, we rode into Harry Bettis Ranch. Bettis was an old Texan and a real Westerner. We had a fine dinner, after which he insisted on staking us to fresh horses. He roped a horse out of the corral for me. I could see at a glance that it was a gentle horse. While I was saddling, he caught one for Earl, and as he led him out of the gate, I noticed that saddle marks were missing. Here was a snaky horse. He was jet black and well-built, and he danced on the end of the rope. As Earl went down the rope with his bridle, Bettis turned to me and said loudly, "For Earl's benefit, Mr. Long, I gave you the kind of spooky horse there, but this one I picked for Earl is a pet of my wife's. She rides him all the time." Many of the ranchers in those days had 1 or 2 horses which might be termed outlaws. They would always buck, and it was considered very funny to stake some innocent rider to one of those and watch the fun. If he expected to fool Earl, though, he was doomed to disappointment. I could see Earl had sized up the situation also. After getting his saddle on the black, Earl took his squirt from the saddle and swung it in his right wrist. The big black stood trembling as Earl swung up, and when he hit the saddle, the horse exploded. Here was a tough horse, all right, and he could sure unwind, but the rider's balance was pretty to watch. Every time the old pony's hit feet on the ground, that quirt came off the end of his nose with a resounding pop. We watched, spellbound, until the horse and rider passed from sight down a hill. The last thing we could see was that quirt rising and falling. Bettis turned to me and said with a grin, "Say, that boy can ride, can't he?" When Earl returned the horse that night, Bettis would not have been stretching the truth at all if he said the next man that his wife could ride him. It was a thoroughly broken horse. That winter was a very mild one, and our loss of cattle was small. I recall one incident, however, that has always amused me. We had a warm day, and the snow had thawed some, but it turned cold in the night. After doing my chores, I saddled up and rode to Tom's place to see how he was doing. As I approached the corral, I could hear some choice cuss words together with a sharp whacking noise, and I became very curious as to just what was going on. Getting closer, I found Tom among the cattle in the corral. At regular intervals, I could see an axe rise above his head and fall with a smack. This was all very puzzling to me, so I rode up to the fence and shouted an inquiry. "Tom, what in the Sam Hill are you doing?" He paused for a moment, then answered, "I'm chopping these cow's tails off so they can get up." The cattle had bedded down with their tails in the wet snow, and as the night grew colder, they froze there. Tom was chopping the long hair off the end of their tails to release them. I just sat on my horse and laughed, but Tom failed to see any humor in the situation at all. We came through our first winter on our new range in Canada with the best of luck and scarcely any loss at all. Little did we realize what we were going to go through the following winter. In the spring, I discovered that I had filed on comparatively poor land. There was only one thing to do: move again. I found an ideal spot on Davis Creek, about 10 miles east of our present location, where the land was flat and the grass grew thicker than hair on a dog's back. The land was also suitable for raising all kinds of feed. We made the move at once, and as time was short, we set up a tent camp, leaving the moving of the house until later. Just before the 1st of June, our roundup wagon started out on the spring gather. We were known then as the White Mud Pool. Fred Garrison was roundup boss, and we sent reps to the T-Down and several other wagons. Our wagon covered the country west as far as Battle Creek, east to East End, Saskatchewan, south to the Montana border, and the Cypress Hills to the north. We handled somewhere around 15,000 cattle, and I centered just north of Cypress Lake. I had to rush home in a few weeks to start haying. I was very fortunate in having a remarkable hay meadow. I could just take out in any direction from camp with a mower and start cutting. That summer, Esther again put up with many hardships. Still watching the horses, she cooked for the hay crew in a tent. There were many vicious lightning storms, followed by driving wind and rain. There were many times when I would be out on a roundup, and she would be alone, or just have another woman with her. It is hard to realize what an electric storm is like in a tent unless you have experienced it. Water always manages to come through or under a tent, and when the wind blows, no matter how well a tent is pitched, some canvas always flaps or pops. The lightning flashes come through the canvas as though it was transparent, and nothing deadens the crash of thunder. When it is all over, cooking with wet wood has to be carried in through the mud follows. In spite of it all, she managed to have a fine meal ready every time the crew or a visiting cowboy appeared. I was able to get up as much or more hay than I had in the fall before, and decided that it was enough. I finished just in time for the fall roundup and had no time to move the house. In this gather, we were short-handed. We had the same territory to cover as we had before and several less men to do it with. That fall will live plainly in my memory always. It was outstanding in the way the cattle handled, and since then I have known and often verified the fact that cattle somehow can tell what kind of a winter lies ahead. No cowboys on the wagon had ever seen cattle act the way they did after we had them gathered and held at center. Never before or since have I seen cattle so restless and hard to hold. 5 nights in succession, they broke away from the middle night guard, and we spent nearly 5 days in rounding them back up again. On the 6th night, Fred Garrison, wagon boss, detailed Chester Gilrich and me to take the middle night guard. His orders were clipped, short, and to the point. Get out there and hold 'em. Don't let 'em get away. Saddling our horses in the dark of night, we rode grimly out to the huge herd, knowing that our job was a tough one and extremely important. Taking over from the first guard, we started around the herd at a moderate pace. As the night wore on, the herd became restless. Before long, the entire herd was on its feet, and we were running our horses at breakneck speed through the darkness. This had to be continued throughout the middle guard, and our horses were nearly played out, but we managed to keep the cattle bunched. About 2 a.m., they became quieter and started to bed down. The danger was past. When morning came, though, they were restless again. This condition existed throughout the entire fall. Even on good range, they knew would move and drift continually. I know now that some warning, some sense endowed them by nature, must have given them knowledge of the terrible winter that was coming. By the middle of October, I had the house moved. We were very thankful to get settled. There were a number of jobs that should have been done, but there was no more time. I had a lot of fencing that I wanted to do before winter, as well as some plowing and other odd jobs, but we felt very fortunate that we had accomplished as much as we had. Frank Kirby and his wife, from Madison, came up that fall and decided to spend the winter with us in our house. This was an extremely lucky break, as we were expecting an addition to our family, and it would have been impossible for Esther to have stayed alone while I rode for cattle that winter. We were heading into the worst, hardest, longest, and toughest winter ever known in Canada and the northern United States. Little did we realize just how bad it could be. That winter has been forever etched into the minds of the northern stockman who endured it, and many an old-timer still marvels at the miracle of surviving it, to say nothing of the stock. Looking back, I, for one, know that God must have had his arms around me many times, or I certainly would not have been here now. On November 14th, 1906, 14 inches of snow fell. My mother had been visiting us and was anxious to get home, so I rushed her to Maple Creek, where she took the train. If we had not gone that morning, I doubt very much if we could have ever made that trip again that winter. The temperature dropped to 20 below and stayed there. Usually when the wind blows and it starts to snow, the temperature will rise, but not that winter. As near as I can remember, it never once got above zero until February. The first snow did not worry us much, as we had plenty of feed, and we were sure that it would soon melt off, as first snows nearly always do. Little did we realize that the king of all winters was just drawing his breath for an extended blow. The wind started to blow and continued every day, not once letting up. The temperature remained steady at around 20 below. The wind was so strong and cold that my cattle started to drift down Davis Creek past Steve Gainan's ranch, where they could find shelter in the heavy brush along the breaks of the White Mud River. Each morning I would be forced to ride there, gather them, and bring them back to feed at the ranch. For days I made this ride, facing those killing blizzards, driving my cattle back home to feed, only to get up the next morning and find them gone again. I could not hold them, as I had not built any fences. I was able to keep my calves at home in a large corral where I fed hay, but this was all. I rode every day from daylight until dark, with the exception of the days when I had to haul hay and wood for fuel. I constantly watched for the expected break in the weather, but none came. After many attempts to hold my cattle on the home range, I finally had to give up and leave them on the range of their own choosing. All I was accomplishing was the wearing down of their strength as well as my own. My face became brown and was continually peeling from frostbite. I became as hardened to the cold as a man could get, and this conditioning was the thing that saved my life in some of the terrible days to follow. Christmas morning came clear, and the thermometer stood at 30 below zero. We had been invited to the Garrisons for dinner. It was 14 miles or better, and I was a little dubious, but the women folks, after being cooped up inside so long, were looking forward to the trip so much that we decided to chance it. One thing in our favor was that the wind was not blowing that morning, and there was a pretty good chance that it would remain still for the rest of the day because it was so cold. I hitched up my best grain-fed team to the bobsled. The women were tucked into quilts and robes and had a large heated rock at their feet. The long trip was made safely, and we arrived at our destination about 11 a.m., cold but happy. The Garrisons were wonderful hosts and served a delicious dinner. Everyone was so glad for a chance to visit that the time passed rapidly. Finally, someone looked out the window and discovered the darkening sky in the north. Looking out, I saw a huge gray mass which resembled a blanket over the entire area from east to west. We all knew only too well what it meant. Another blizzard was building up. When I stepped outside for a better look, I noticed that the day was as still as death. It was the lull before the storm in that already frozen country. Hastening preparations, we were all bundled into the box of the sled and were ready to go by 3 p.m. The Garrisons hated to see us start, but we had stock shut up in our corrals and they would face starvation if we were gone too long. Besides, everything in our house would freeze overnight. We could have left the women to come later, but we never knew how long these storms would last, and they insisted on going with us. Soon after we left, the north wind began to blow, and then the snow began falling in clouds. By the time we were halfway home, we couldn't see 20 feet in front of us, and on top of that, it was getting dark. As we plodded on, the others became completely lost, and soon decided I was lost too. I felt sure, however, that I knew where I was. A man out in these storms every day acquires a sense of direction, and this I was relying on now. Everyone else wanted to turn back, but I was sure that we were getting closer to home than we were to the Garrisons, and somehow I knew that we were going in the right direction. Long after dark, we were still going, and it seemed to me that we should be getting pretty close to home. A terrible fear came over me. Had I missed the place? Everyone was getting mighty cold, and I knew that we must find shelter soon or perish. Suddenly, my team stopped, and with watering eyes, I thought I could see a dark object in front of them. Hanging up the lines, I got stiffly out of the sled and walked ahead to investigate. It was our barn, and we were home. With a shout of pure joy, I informed the others. It is hard to explain the feeling of elation as we trudged from the shed to the protection of the house. We all realized that we had missed death by a very small margin on this Christmas day. The terrible blizzard lasted for several days. It was impossible to do anything but feed and cut wood for fuel. To ride in that storm would have been suicide. The thermometer plunged to the bottom and stayed there. Steve Gainan had been wintering his calves at one of the neighbors, a man named Ben Wright. Just before New Year's, Ben ran out of hay, and Steve was forced to move his calves. It was about 16 miles of trail, and I offered to help him with the drive. New Year's Day, 1907, broke clear and cold, with the thermometer standing on 60 below zero. As we started our drive, the air was so cold that the frost almost seemed to snap in the air. We took a few older cattle to break trail for the calves. I was dressed in a fur cap, fur coat, and fur chaps with German socks and overshoes on my feet. It was still foolhardy to ride more than half a mile without walking to get warm. We walked most of the day. We had to be careful how we breathed, or our lungs would become frosted. The snow was deep, and we could only make 12 miles by sundown. We left the cattle, and where the snow permitted, began to trot our horses. We had only gone a short distance when I looked at Steve and instantly pulled my horse to a walk. His nose and part of his face was dead white and frozen. After I warned him, he looked at me and informed me that mine was the same. We stopped and rubbed our faces until the circulation returned. From then on, we were forced to walk our horses, for the slight breeze created by the faster pace would freeze us at once. If there had been any wind at all that day, we would not have been able to exist. The bitter cold lasted all through January. Whenever it warmed up the least bit, the wind rose and severe blizzard conditions prevailed. The country looked like the Arctic Circle. It felt like it, too. When the snow drifted into the sheltered coulees and creek bottoms, it became so deep it covered the trees. Cattle seeking shelter in these places would keep the snow packed hard around a tree until, as the snow kept drifting in, they would eventually be on top of the tree. They then would move on if possible. If not, they would die there. I was forced to stay at Steve's so we could work together to save our cattle. We had to ride every day, no matter what the weather was. Every morning, the cattle would leave the shelter and go out on the ridges to graze until the wind came up. Their trails became hard, frozen, and slippery, and they all became footsore. Many of them would lie down at night and curl their heads around their side trying to keep what warmth they had in their poor frozen bodies. In the morning, we would find them floundering around trying to get up, their necks so stiff from the cold they were unable to straighten them out. We would dismount and, catching hold of their heads, straighten their necks, and after a few moments, they would get up. One day at Steve's, while eating dinner, we looked out the window and saw about 100 antelope pawing for grass on the hillside a short distance away. We both seized our coats, caps, and rifles and sneaked out the back door. We crawled through the snow to a point where we could get good shots and then let ourselves be seen. When they spotted us, they all began to run, converging on the mouth of the coulee in the bunch. We opened fire, and when the herd was gone, we had 5 dead ones. We dressed them out, hung them in the trees in back of the house, and had fine antelope steaks for many days. By the 1st of February, we were nearly out of feed for our cattle. We had previously bought some hay from a man by the name of Nelson, who lived on Dry Coulee, about 15 miles south of the White Mud River. We knew that it was impossible to move the hay, so we prepared to move the cattle to it. We cut out about 300 head that we thought could stand the trip, and Fred Garrison came over to help us make the move. The morning we began the trip south, we were greatly surprised to find the temperature had risen considerably. It was like suddenly being released from a great burden, and we were in fine spirits. The long-dreamed Chinook was about to happen. It was the warmest day we had had for nearly 4 months. Steve was in the lead with the team and sled to break the trail through the deep snow. Fred and I strung the herd out behind. We were forced to travel slowly as the cattle were all pretty weak. We were only a short distance south of the White Mud when, turning in the saddle, I saw with surprise the dreaded gray blanket spread over the northern sky. The wind had gone down, and I think that is what made me look. There was no time for any preparations, for almost at once the blizzard was upon us. It struck with a pent-up fury which seemed to be trying to override the few hours of decent weather we had enjoyed. The wind howled and gust, and snow from the heavens came riding it down the prairie. The temperature fell at once, and visibility was cut less than 50 feet, and oftentimes to nothing. This looked like the worst storm of the winter, and we were in a fine position, caught flat-footed, so to speak, halfway between the White Mud River and our hay with 300 head of sore-footed and weak cattle. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we got together to discuss our chances. It was a grim meeting. We all knew that, at best, we had a 50-50 chance for survival. We decided to drift with the wind, which, we prayed, had not changed directions. If it came out above Nelson's in the bottom of the dry coulee, we would hit a sleigh road and be able to follow it in. If we were to bear too far west and come out below Nelson's, we were to be lost, as we probably would not even notice the coulee, as it was not that deep. There was not another landmark to go by between us and the Milk River in Montana, and no living thing could survive that long in such a storm. We decided to stay with the cattle another half hour, and if nothing showed up to guide us, we would leave them to their fate and make a desperate effort to save ourselves. As we ended our talk, we looked at each other with a deep feeling unspoken. Each one of us knew that our chances were mighty slim at the best. Not one of us had any idea where we were. The good Lord must have been riding with us again that day, for finally, we hit the hard sleigh road. We knew that the cattle would follow with no help from us, so we went on ahead to get out of the biting cold. Safe in Mr. Nelson's house around a roaring fire, we all agreed that we were as near death that day as any of us cared to be. The following morning, there was a good stiff breeze blowing from the northwest, and it was 35 below zero. But the sky was clear. Our cattle were all in off the trail. They had resembled walking icicles. There were from 3 to 4 inches of ice frozen on them, and they actually squeaked when they walked. But they were on hay now, and safe at last. Fred and I were worried about things at home, and we knew that they would be even more worried about us, so we decided to head back. It was about 20 miles across country with practically no shelter, and we had not gone far before we were beating our hands and walking to keep from freezing. By the time we reached Garrison's, we were very near exhaustion. We found things in pretty bad shape at Garrison's. The calves had gone out to try to graze a little in the warm of that first day. We found 35 head in a fence corner, piled up and frozen to death. This was just one bunch. There were others scattered over a wide area. Garrison lost half of his calves in that one storm. The following day, I rode for home, and if anything, it was colder that day than the day before. I would walk until I gave out or until my lungs began to burn, and then I would ride until I started to freeze again. The entire trip was the worst I had ever made in a full lifetime on the range. All through March, the terrible weather hammered at us without one single let-up. One blizzard after another hit, and in all my life, I have never seen any winter that would come close to being its equal. On April 1st, Esther and I took a grain-fed team and made the 20-mile trip to Maple Creek. The trip was not an easy one, especially for Esther. Plowing through the huge drifts, it seemed to take forever to get anywhere. From Maple Creek, we took the train to Great Falls, Montana, where our oldest boy, Wayne, was born April 13th, 1907. We arrived back in Maple Creek on May 8th. Winter had just started to break up, and the water was starting to run. As we drove along the ridges, we could see that the creeks were still full of snow. The drifts were completely over the brush and trees, and it made the country look oddly level. Thus ended the hardest winter that has ever been known in the livestock business in the prairie country, of which I write. There has never been another, to my knowledge, that could even compare with this one, and I remember 80 of them. I hope I never have to see another like it. 95% of the northern cattlemen were broke by spring. Yes, this was the king of them all. The late spring was what finally dropped the axe on these cattlemen. Many of the large cattle outfits had plenty of hay, but after winter had hit, they could not get the hay to the cattle or the cattle to the hay. There were dead cattle everywhere. One old-timer tells of so many cattle drifting into Milk River and dying there that their bodies dammed the river in the spring. It was a terrible sight. Lifelong dreams were wiped out in a matter of months. The big outfits were hurt the worst. The Smith and Musset Cattle Company shipped in 3,200 head of Manitoba Dogies in the fall of 1906 and put them on their ranch north of the Saskatchewan River, directly north of Maple Creek. In the spring, they had about 250 left. Other large outfits, such as the 76, Circle Diamond T Down, the V, and many others, were nearly out of business, but managed to build back up again. Nevertheless, this was the beginning of the end for the large cattle kingdoms, and many, many small cattlemen were completely wiped out. I came through the winter better than most, as I was running mostly dry stuff. The huge Turkey Track outfit turned loose 15,000 head of cattle, mostly mixed steers, that fall. They were ranging on the Neville Divide between the Swift Current Saskatchewan and the White Mud River. In the spring, there were not enough cattle left to run a wagon. I remember well the next summer talking to the manager of the Turkey Track, Tony Day, in a hotel lobby in Medicine Hat, Alberta. Turning to some farmers who were present, Tony, with a hint of moisture in his eyes, said resignedly, "You fellows of your profession have chased me from the lands of old Mexico north across the Canadian border, and now you can have it all." These words of utter defeat from a great man may have lingered in my memory a long time. They were typical of many great cattlemen that spring who could see the end of their huge cattle empires.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.